Welcome to The Radical Therapist. We are now at episode number 124. My name is Chris Hoff. And as always, thanks for listening. Today we have a wonderful episode with the longtime narrative therapy practitioner, writer, teacher, trainer, therapist, what have you, Stephen Madigan. So I've been wanting to have this conversation for a long time, and we were able to make it happen, and I'm very excited about that. And before we get to Stephen, I have one quick announcement. Some of you might know that in my day job, I direct a California Family Institute, which is a nonprofit located in Southern California. And we are a community counseling practice, and we also train graduate, postgraduate therapists that are interested in, you know, post-structural narrative, collaborative therapy, and yeah, all the stuff. So besides that, it's our 10th anniversary. Yeah, we've been doing this for 10 years. And in my community, the numbers are those who have that sought help in my community, nearly 50% of the people that have sought help, meaning looking for a therapist, that kind of thing, could not access that help. And so that's our mission. And nobody's turned away, no matter what they can afford. And it's our 10th year. We're having our first ever fundraiser. So yes, this is an appeal. I don't know what kind of appeal, but, you know, I'm just putting it out there. If anybody wants to, we're doing a month of May event. So you'll probably hear stuff from me, but we're doing a no gala. You can buy a ticket to not attend. So how's that? So anyway, and we'll take any donation. It doesn't matter how small, to support the services, that kind of thing. So, or if you want to sponsor, if you have a practice or a training program or whatever, and you want to, you know, we'll spread your word. I mean, we're going to talk a lot about you for the month of May. So, and there's sponsorship opportunities for that too. So, if you're not already, come follow us at Instagram at California Family Institute, or you can follow me on my Instagrams. I don't know how much I'll be mentioning it on the Radical Therapist Instagram, but, you know, come follow the California Family Institute Instagram, and you can stay in touch with all of that and any sort of help or support, or even just sharing our message, you know, while we're doing all this stuff. That would be really, really helpful too. That works. So anyway, that's my appeal for this episode. And so let's get to our guest. Yeah, long time coming. Really happy to have had this conversation. For the few of you that might not know, Stephen Madigan is an award-winning narrative therapist, best-selling author, training director of the Vancouver School of Narrative Therapy, content manager for VSNT.live. I'll have links for both of those places in the show notes. And he's a longtime supervisor to international high couple conflict teams. He wrote the first ever doctoral dissertation on narrative therapy, and his therapy work is studied in graduate university programs across the world through various media forms, such as the American Psychological Association's production of a set of 6 professional learning videos filming his live narrative practice. He wrote the best first and second editions of the book, Narrative Therapy, published in 2011 and in 2019, and the third edition will be published soon in July 2024. Stephen teaches, trains, and consults, supervises globally. So without further ado, let's meet Stephen. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Chris. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, thank you for making the time. And really happy to have you here, and being able to have this conversation. And you have been a trainer of me. I've attended a couple of trainings at least up in Vancouver, and of course the conference that you hold. And I've fell in love with Vancouver because of that. but I appreciate all of that and the work that you do, and you know, I just really appreciate you making the time. I guess I would like to start by, I know this is a big question, but I guess I would like to maybe start by asking about your journey in narrative practice. There may be some listeners that don't know your story, and I was wondering if you could share a bit about your journey and how you were introduced to this way of working and its evolution in your life and work.
Yeah. Thanks, Chris. That is so well, I'll give you the shortened version. Because, as you know, I can be, I'm Irish and I couldn't be long-winded, but I'll try and give you the short version. But before I answer, who is the audience that we're speaking with? Just so I can locate it and locate our conversation
we
a
are,
little bit.
I'm fortunate to have an international audience, and I do get a lot of emails from folks that are in training programs, graduate school, et cetera. So a lot of folks that are very interested in these ways of working that don't really get them in the programs that they're at and use this as a resource to kind of support the work that they're trying to do.
Okay. So, I'm very fond of the next generation of narrative therapists. And we could talk about the context of learning that they're attempting to learn and practice in, which I think is probably significantly different to our generation and how I started out. I don't know. I come from a very pro-Irish immigrant family, working class family. And I grew up with the Irish diaspora in this working class neighborhood. And it was quite Catholic, my upbringing. And people said, how did you survive? Are you a recovered Catholic? I never think about it that way, because my parents and their friends were very much on the end of, if we could say, socialist Catholics. Mm-hmm. So they really had a great desire and a great practice of looking after the poor and the dispossessed. And give you examples, my parents began and helped start the first summer camp for inner city youth, very impoverished youth. My father looked and went to a seniors home, mm-hmm. very large seniors home, and for every Monday for probably 35 years. And he'd bring tobacco and chocolate, and you could smoke back then. And he was a great singer, so he'd sing songs. And so we were always connected to a community of help. It was just not our family, but not only our family, but mm-hmm. the families that surrounded us. Anyway, so that's a bit of familial background. My older sister, Anne, has an MSW. The other thing was education. So she has an MSW. Then she went to the London School of Economics and got a policy degree. And then she went to medical school. And then she practices. She was really involved in women's health. And then didn't like, I think, all the all it takes to be a practicing family physician. So she moved more into psychiatry, and she uses narrative therapy. My little sister, Mary, we call her my little sister, but she doesn't mind that. Her job now is she is the chief people person of Toronto. So she manages 46,000 people. So all of us have this propensity to be involved and connected with community and service, I suppose. I left Toronto, went to Calgary. I was 21 or 22. I became a group therapist in this new facility for kids that were youth that were on the verge of either prison or the psychiatric institute. Mm. They wanted a group therapist. I raised my hand and I got the job. And so we were in Calgary at the time, and just up the hill was perhaps the mecca for family therapy in the world at that time. It was Carl Tom's program. So we were all trained in Milan style family therapy. Mm-hmm. I was on the family therapy team. We had one-way screens. All this was completely new to me. I was supervised every day by two psychoanalysts. I was doing transference interpretation groups as well at the same time. Anyway, long story short, I went to UBC to do my master's in social work, fell in love with the mountains and the ocean, was supervised by a fellow by the name of Dr. David Freeman. He was the supervisor of the clinical program at the time in social work, and he was the heir apparent to Murray Bowen. He was from Brooklyn. He studied under Bowen, so I grew up in Bowen as well. He ran something called the Pacific Coast Family Therapy Training Institute. So at the time I was doing my degree in social work, after the second year, I got very close to him. This is a story of people really taking care of me. And he said, we'd like to give you a scholarship. Would you like to do this in your final year of your MSW? I'll help you write your thesis, blah, blah, blah. And I did. And then he got me the job in a place called Family Services. Now, at the time, all the top therapists, I think this was the same across Canada, they worked in public agencies. Mm-hmm. And public agencies were incredibly well-funded. So I was on this team, this elite team, who all taught at the Pacific Coast Training Institute. They were all like 8, 12 years older. And so we had supervision. We had one-way screens. I just thought this was normal. And so I'd come from the tradition of Carl Tom, who was bringing in people like Boscolo and Chiquin and Humberto Maturana and all sorts of different people. I came to Vancouver, and David Freeman was doing the same. So we saw everyone. I remember in my MSW program, they asked for a volunteer who could bring forth a family because Salvador Minuchin was coming into town, and I didn't know anything. I put up my hand and then worked with him, and then he wanted to, I don't know why, but he said, can I go out with you tomorrow? And so he took me out for lunch and talked to me all about stroke. So the education was across the board. Everyone was studying family therapy. And I think this was perhaps I got fortunate because I had an older sister, Anne, who I mentioned, who grew up sort of in the late 60s, early 70s, brought me into that halcyon days of the political culture. Mm-hmm. The same with family therapy. I was on the tail end when family therapy was just this enormously interesting foundation of ideas and practices. So that led me to reading, I don't know, everybody, and meeting people and becoming really interested in the field of family therapy. And then a quick story, when I was doing my MSW, I was really missing my friends in Calgary. So I phoned up Carl Tom's clinic, and he answered the phone by chance. I said, "Hi, Carl, I don't know if you remember me." He said, "Yeah, of course I remember you." Well, I said, "Yeah, I want to come visit my friends, but I have this thing, like I couldn't just go on a holiday. I don't know what it means to go on holiday. You have to do it along with something, you know, still to this day, I think." So he said, "Yeah," he says, "I know that you're really interested in Gregory Bateson," which he turned me on to. And he said, "I'm going to be teaching through the ideas of Humberto Maturana," who I met with Carl. Do you ever read the Maturana's article called The Biology of Language?
A long time ago. Yeah.
I don't know how many times it took you, but it took me, I know, 11 readings to sort of conceptually go. And he said, he would agree with that. But they were fantastic ideas. And he said, "I'm bringing in someone who is speaking through the ideas of Gregory Bates." And I said, "Cool, great." So I went, was with my friends, stayed up way too late, partying and whatever, went to the workshop. I remember, and I was reminded afterwards by Michael White. It was Michael White who was, and it was one of the first times he'd been in North America. So I kind of showed up with, you know, a bit rough, you know, with a leather jacket on, a motorcycle boots and a Neil Young t-shirt. I remember that. And he made a beeline to me. He always turned out, went to sort of address the person most unlikely to be at the workshop, and that was me. And then one thing led to another. He invited me up to watch him work. So there was Carl, and there were two other really eminent people. One was a family therapist, one was a group therapist, and Michael did the Sneaky Poo interview on and Caprices. And I had a pretty good background. I mean, I was really young, but I had a pretty good background back then, or at least I thought I did. And I'd never witnessed anything like this before. I had no idea what he was doing. He was just moving into Foucault at that time. And I don't know, Chris, I don't know. Have you ever had that lightning experience where you, I just thought, I don't know what this guy's doing, but I want to be able to do it. So long story short, I kept in touch with Michael. I went to do my doctorate in America because we didn't have one in Canada at the time in marriage and family therapy. And one thing led to another. I'd kept in touch, and the Dulles Center, tell me if I'm going on too long, the Dulles Center had this scholarship they were going to give out, family therapy training scholarship. But I'd come up from Florida, first time Michael came to Vancouver, and I was there, and they kind of, I had had a sort of a relationship with them, but not many, but I was probably the person they knew the most. So they took me in, and we had dinner, and it was just fantastic. And anyway, the long story short of it is, and I can tell you this now, and I'm sure Sherilyn won't mind, but they kind of rigged the scholarship. Like, there was one for a woman and one for a man. And Sal Mnuchin applied for the scholarship. But they gave it to me. So that was my big deal. Like, well, yeah, Sal Mnuchin applied, but I got the scholarship. So I went and I studied with and lived with Michael and Cheryl. And I went through the programs, and then I stayed on, and then just went to work with Michael. We rode our bikes in. Basically, what I did, I sat in the room with him and wrote down every question that he asked. And I was just fascinated with the purpose, the direction, the grammar, the politic, everything that was going on. And I didn't really have a sensibility, but I was watching people respond. So at night, we would go out and we'd talk politics because I was learning, self-studying Foucault at the time and post-structuralism. And Cheryl was a great influence in terms of feminist thinking. And then they sent me to the Just Therapy team of Charles Waldegrave in Temelai, Kiwi, Temesisi. I spent 10 days with them, and I got off the plane, I remember, and we went to a housing protest. So this was all making sense to me, because even when I was studying family of origin and all the rest of it in Milan, I was very involved in grassroots organizing. So I do the political work at night and then do therapy. And what I was finding with narrative is that I didn't have to separate them. So the next year, and I went to Nova Southeastern University. And Ron Chennai was the, I don't know if you know Ron.
I know the name. I don't know him. No.
Yeah, he started the qualitative report. There was a brilliant set of people there. They were primarily MRI. Solution focused, and a bit of social construction, social constructionists. But they gave me the room to do a dissertation on narrative therapy. It turned out to be the first one. I didn't know that. Michael then invited me back the next year during and they paid my flight, and I went and I stayed and I worked. And so I was just, again, extremely well taken care of. And I worked hard, meaning that he would ask a question, I'd write them all down, and at night I'd annotate the questions and figure out, you know, is this a relative influence question? Is this a unique outcome? Is this a experience of experience? Anyway, so on my last visit there, he and Cheryl, I remember it clear as day, we were in this little Italian restaurant, and on the back of the map, they said, here's the training program we want you to start. And I said, look, first of all, I'm broke. But the other part of it is, I'm not sure I can do this. You know, I'm never really taught or anything like that. But they were really encouraging. So fast forward and move back. The other thing they said was, we really encourage you not to work for anyone for 5 years, which I thought was a brilliant idea. But I'll go back to the idea that I was broke. But anyway, I managed to get a loan from my parents, $4,000. I opened up what is now Yaletown Family Therapy, the Vancouver School. And I moved in to the office. I got the office. It was in an old warehouse, brick and timber, and they had a shower on the fifth floor, which was part of the reason. So I just moved the futon in and then got a contract with the film industry, and the rest was history. So then we were moving, and I had a good friend, Heather Elliott was her name. She followed me, but she'd worked at Family Services. She went down to Nova as well and did the second dissertation on narrative therapy, and it was postmodernism, feminism, and narrative therapy. So then the next year, I just decided I didn't like the conferences I was going to. I'm trying to be respectful, but it was just, I come from East Scarborough. It just seemed a bit straight. And I mean that in the nicest word, liberal and well-meaning. But everyone was wearing suits. There weren't people of color. There weren't queer. So I thought, I'm going to try this conference thing. And I had no idea what I'd doing. But I thought, Chris, if I get the social thing right, we're good. So the first keynotes were Charles and Kiwi speaking on social justice and race and culture. Michael was the next year, and then the rest is history. Is that a good enough history?
That's wonderful history. And it segues into my next question very nicely. And that's, well, now you have a long history of teaching narrative practice through the Vancouver School and internationally. And I mean, I guess I'm wondering what your thoughts are about teaching this work across contexts, cultures, and what have you found successful, and what are you starting to leave behind, that kind of thing.
Well, you don't start out knowing much. You just think, even though I'd studied Maturana, you're figuring there's instructive interaction. It goes A to B. And obviously it doesn't. So the more that I was less engaged in the teaching and more engaged with the cultures and the communities I was teaching in, I just slowed it down. And, you know, for years and years, I was teaching across five continents every year, which was amazing opportunity. So what I began to do, Chris, is to really get to know the communities before I accepted to go. And I'd say, how did you find out? What's your interest in narrative therapy? Can you tell me a little bit about your community? What do you think your community interest is? I don't know a whole lot about your culture. We're going to be using translators, be it Spanish or French or Portuguese or Norwegian. And we are really going to have to look at this in terms of how this work that I'm going to present is taken up and becomes a narrative therapy dependent on the cultural context that it's being received in. And I said, I won't know how to do that, but I will afford lots of room inside the teaching rooms where that's going to be the piece of discussion. So we can talk about relational externalizing. We can talk about it being moving away from an internal state psychology and locating people into cultural context. But I don't really know what your cultural context is. You're going to have to do this. The other thing was, another piece of that was, so this is a slow learning that I was learning from these places. But then I began to work more intimately in supervision over in Norway with two particular teams, and I was supervising their teams in couple therapy, and so what I was asking them to do, and it took a rigorous amount of work, and I'm so thankful that they were up for the level of work. I won't do supervision unless there's a therapy tape or a transcript, so we couldn't do it by videotape because all of the sessions were in Norwegian. So they would tape it, translate it into Norwegian, then translate it into English. And then they would send it to me. Then I would look at this. So we would spend, and we continued to, I continued to do this. We spent so much time looking at the question that was asked in Norwegian and the answer, but then we would look at how that translates and the difference of meanings. And they would again have to tutor me and educate me into cultural meanings and expectations that are very, very different. So they really helped me, I guess, understand that when we do this work, we have to be extremely respectful. And also, even though you're teaching the work, you really don't have a sensibility of how it's going to be taken up culturally.
Sure.
I don't know if that answers your
Yes,
question.
yes, thank you. Now let's talk about your narrative-informed relational interviewing, a lot of work that you've been doing these last years. And I guess maybe let's start by maybe asking, how does it differ from traditional conflict-focused approaches in couple therapy, which seem to be dominant? And you do this unique thing of what is the purpose of starting with a full story of the relationship's creation and foundational values before addressing conflicts?
Could I just go back a little
Sure, of
bit
course.
just to like contextualize it a
Sure.
little bit? Okay, so part of what I need to do is to say that it's just to talk about the couples that I work with, and because I'm on Zoom, I see a lot of people on Zoom from many different places. But when I started the work, Chris, it was people coming to the office in Vancouver. So the age range is 20, in their 20s to their 80s. I don't work with, I'm just situating questions that always come up. I won't work where there's current or recent violence. I only see couples in couple therapy. I won't see individuals. I work alongside a wide variety of social locations, including race, sexualities, class, immigration, immigrant, religious, and non-religious. Historically, Chris, I've always managed my therapy where 25% of it's free and 75% of it is paying. The paying part is probably some of the higher rates that are around in Vancouver, but it's kind of like this those rates afford free rates, so I don't have a sliding scale or anything. So this allows me to see the broad range of persons, and I guess the other thing that I should say is that the oops, I lost you there. Vancouver has the highest per capita biracial marriage rate across the world. And it's not only biracial, it's bicultural. So that's really reflective in my practice. So what we were talking about in terms of culture, in terms of how it translates, that shows up in the relational therapy work. Your quest, so look, I'll just say it this way. I started off, and the couple therapy that I was doing and had been taught, there was something missing. I could viscerally feel it in my body, and I was getting frustrated with myself. I never get frustrated with the couples. I was thinking, what the hell is going on here? Like something is missing. And so I set out, like, this isn't a heroic journey by any stretch of the, it's a really actually humbling journey. So I just thought, well, I'm going to look at this and then I'm going to create something new. But it didn't quite work out that way. And I was fumbling. And so what I decided to do is look at what I called the ecology of the receiving context I'm receiving couple relationship stories into. So we all have one of these, Chris, the ecology of how we receive stories, right? Not only therapists, but that's who we're talking to. So, you know, this is like looking at the broad range of that symphony of interlocking ideas that are theoretical, they're personal, they're historical, they're political, they're relational. It's like, you know, Foucault has this saying, maybe I'm bastardizing it, it's something like, it doesn't really matter where you stand, it's what you stand for that matters. So that was central. Like, what do I actually stand for here when I'm receiving these highly conflicted stories? So I spent a lot of time doing that. And I think many therapists who are listening, we can be pretty good at that. Like, we can sit down with our colleagues and go through an exercise of interviewing ourselves or the other about where we stand. The difficulty for me was, this is the second part, is so now we've got the ecology of the receiving context. The next part is, well, how do we respond to this story in a coherent, consistent way from where it is we say we stand? So I just thought, well, I'm a fairly schooled narrative therapist, this will be cool. And it wasn't. And for the first time in so long, I was struggling with the questions that I was creating, because one of the tenets I found was, okay, one of the starting points is that relationships are relational and they cannot be otherwise. And that means all questions needed to be relational, contextual. So that's how it began. So I take the word, I did what, you know, everybody in supervision does, and struggled, and got excited, but felt humiliated. And anyway, but gradually moved along, and then I began to bring, like sort it out. So one of the things, if we come from a place, if people can just for a moment come from a place that relationships are relational, what that means is really moving away from internal state psychology, like in a very serious way. And what does that mean? And this is not a critique of internal state psychology, couple therapists, but the field of couple therapy is driven across the board, particularly the more popular ones we find out about, from an internal state psychology. And what that means is, in loose terms, is that couples come in and present their surface behavior of what is wrong. And then through deductive reasoning, we try and finalize and interpret what the meaning of the surface behavior could be, conflict, arguing, affairs, whatever it might be, down to a cause or a truth status. And then we find our, so that's the etiology of what's going on. And then we find a way to practice going forward. So, but I just began, I mean, this is the narrative training and post-structural training, which you're a very wise post-structuralist, you understand all this. This did not make sense. Like, how do we explain? How do we explain, or give credence to, or have compassion with, that this is a couple relationship embedded in a cultural context? And that cultural context has a wide series of influences that directly shape the practices of the couple relationship. So when we're thinking about that, we look at various social norms and obligations and expectations and responsibilities that anyone that's in a relationship understands and is a part of and practices. We can't get away from those practices. And so that begin to shape, when we embed the relationship inside a context, the cultural context of norms and objectives, and who's in and who's out and what constitutes the proper relationship or parent or worker or whatever it might be. This failure that they see or this conflict that they're experiencing, that relationship did not get there by itself. And so you were asking about the starting point. And I think, again, respectfully, when you are a dysfunction-focused couple therapist, you're looking for the dysfunction. I can see the interest in that, and that's where the training is.
Right.
But it's only a partial story, and it's a very individualist story, and it disembodies the relationship from the cultural context. So I think all therapy begins with memory. It's all situated in memory. And the difference is, I think that the more internal state psychology-driven couple therapists, their memory focus is a memory of suffering. And they want to know the story of the suffering to get it down to the origins of the suffering that may predict why they are performing their relationship in particular ways. I think that's an interesting story, but it's only a partial story. I think what we neglect as couple therapists is the full story of the relationship itself. So that's where I like to begin, Chris. I would like to know what we could call the pre-problem relationship foundation was built on, and what we find, and you were addressing this, it's usually based on what we call values or valuing, or quite simply what the couple cares for. So what that does, I mean, that, so if we look at the way I was trained in narrative therapy, is to get the two different stories and maybe have people witness it. I already assume there's a counter story, because relationships, I don't know about you or people out there, but they usually don't start with great argument and conflict. Right? So there is this beautiful, wonderful story to remember. And then I'm being really impolite. I'm sorry.
You're doing a great job of answering like three of my questions right now. So keep going.
Are you going to jump in at some point?
I would
like your opinion on this.
No, I'm fascinated. I'm following you. So please.
Okay. So, well, I don't know how fascinating it is, but what we began to focus on are a couple things: memory, the full story of the relationship, not the partial story, and the idea of values or valuing or what the relationship cares for, what they stand in. And so memory, if we look at memory, and memory is also a great part of therapy, you know, right from its origins. I should mention at this point, since 2016, 2017, on the faculty, like the primary faculty is Rosa Arteaga.
Faculty of the Vancouver School.
For Narrative Therapy. Rosa Elena Arteaga from Mexico and Vancouver, from Mexico City and Vancouver. Christine Denstedt, who lives up in Whistler in the Rocky Mountains. Best ski hill voted in North America for the last two decades.
I've skied it.
You've seen it?
I've skied it, yeah.
Oh, you skied it? Oh, fantastic. Yeah, it's pretty far out, isn't it?
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah.
Who I won't tell you what they're all doing these days, but if we have a chance, I will. Helena Grau Christensen from Copenhagen. Two California people you know, David Nyland and David Nyland from Sacramento, David Marsden from your neck of the woods in Los Angeles. And then we have a resident philosopher, and his name is Todd May. And he's just not a regular philosopher. He's just written so many books on a wide variety of topics, 17 and counting, but he also has written on Foucault and Deleuze. And he's taken this painstakingly taken us through ideas and all of our questions. But also he's written a lot about what it means to be human and what do we care about. He's written books on death. And anyway, so he helps us with ideas, say, around memory. Now, I know that this, what I'm going to say, is pretty much common knowledge. But when we're in the therapy room, a memory is not a photograph. Right? And so the beautiful piece of memory is that, like, when we think about our work, and I think narrative therapy gets mistranslated in some ways or misdirected, we're not going back from this one story, problematic, saturated story, and trying to dismantle that and then finding what the real truth is. I mean, because that participates in internal psycho. We're not swapping one truth from another truth.
Right.
The other thing is that we're not discovering an alternative story or a counter story. They're not there. You know, it's not as if we start here, Chris, and this is the problem story. And then what that has done is, like, imagine it as a file cabinet, restrain the other stories in a person's life. So we're moving from, when we think about memory, we're moving from discovery to look at memory as landscapes of creativity.
Interesting.
So when we recount or remember a story, they're not remembering it, the event of love or trust or kindness from the moment it happened. They're actually embodying it and creating the memory differently, co-creating it in a new way, and then hopefully beginning to bring that forward.
I'm really appreciating that landscape of creativity because I've been in my work, I've been interested in not so much memory, but going into the future. And I like that languaging of lands, because the same thing I think applies when you go out into the future too, that there is a landscape of creativity at play, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard, you know, like your work in the future, it would involve imagination. And I don't think that we can evoke imagination without it being some kind of creative act,
right?
You know, if we language it in that in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, so thank you for that language. Yeah.
Well, you can thank Todd May for that. and the rest of the faculty were, but I think that idea that we're not discovering, we're creating, is a monumental piece. We had a long debate about it as well. We get together almost as a social group and talk about this, and Todd was laying this out. And so then we had a debate, was what was Michael's intention, Michael White's intention? And we agreed that Michael White, for many, many years, including ourselves, may have been misinterpreted. You know, I don't think he was going back and looking at trying to, although he did use Derrida, and Derrida kind of has that idea, but we're not huge fans of Derrida, but that's a whole other story. But it is, so how we produce the remembering and the questions that we evoke in relational remembering, they're tricky, or at least I found them tricky to try and create. The other thing that I focus on is I'm less involved in the individuals of the relationship and more involved in the relationship. Mm-hmm. So the easy way to look at this is, for me anyway, is that the whole is far, far more interesting than the individual parts. So I have this idea, and like anything in narrative therapy, you start out relationally externalizing. By the way, I want us to move away from the word externalizing. Hmm. And it was a beautiful, beautiful concept. Absolutely. You know, the person is not the problem. The problem is the problem. You know, a central, simple tenet, but brilliant, but Michael figured out. But I think it might be easier for your audience and everyone else, clients included, that instead of externalizing problems, we relationally contextualize problems. Hmm. Because then we more easily make the post-structural jump to contextualize and say, what is a context? And what is a context of influence? And how does it influence? And what is surrounding us? And I think when it comes to couple therapy, I mean, can we really explain world events? And I say this respectfully through Bowlby's theory of attachment. Mm. Like, come on, come on. That's a question. Do you think?
I think I'm on record.
I know you are. That's cool.
Yeah, but I'm on record.
Anyway, so you know, couples sort of are engaged in the idea that the relationship that they created can't take care of itself. The relationship that they created thrives and becomes an identity by what they serve. And then what we look at, though, and I think this is, I certainly overlooked it, when we go through the remembering piece, and I go through it very slowly, of how they met. 70% of the, or approximately, people I work with met as friends and then went through a rite of passage and it became intimate and sexual, and there's a variety. But each couple is, when asked the questions properly and curiously, have sets of foundational values that were very meaningful. So there's that as the construct, and then there are the practices of those values. So what a practice is sort of how our social practices, like you and I are doing this right now, intersect with one another. And so how do they take up these social practices, and how are they received, and what did that then create as a foundational value for the relationship? I think my experience is, when you go through this, my first sessions are 90 minutes. So the first 10 is why they've come, and do they want to separate? Do they want to repair? It's really two things happen, is that they find common ground. The conflicts is present.
Sure.
But what's happening is we're creating a difference, a transformative tension and difference with the conflict. So they find a common ground. But the other thing that happened, and this is something I missed in years of doing couple therapy, is that in remembering that, they also experience a tremendous sense of loss and grief of what they once had, but now the conflict has helped them remember to forget or remember to practice. So that's a big piece of the work, is to escalate that tension. I don't know, where are we, Chris?
That's great. No, you you went through like four of my questions. I love it. And maybe,
well, they were good questions that you posed. So
no, that was I'm going to say to the audience, if you want to know more, you know, look up the Vancouver School of Narrative Therapy and Stephen
and VSNT.live. There's a lot of it on there.
And you can delve much deeper into this work. Maybe I'll two more questions for the sake of time.
Sure.
And I'm really interested in your, because I know you are seeing a lot of different things. So what do you see emerging in narrative practice these days? What sort of futures are you excited about? Yeah.
Oh, gosh. You ask me these big questions, and now it's like, okay. And they're beautiful questions. So maybe we can visit again at some later date.
I hope so.
But, I feel that the people that I work alongside, and they teach and supervise a lot of people, they've made just a dramatic turn into relational questions and relation, and like viewing the relational and the contextual, the cultural and the political. Now, I know that narrative therapy, that's its traditions, but I feel that we are interviewing relationships more. We are considering relationships more. So Alina's work is asking these relational questions. I interview the relationship by itself. If I was to interview the relationship, about this act of kindness? Do you believe that it grew the relationship up or down? I also write letters directly to the relationship, but we won't get into that. And so we are moving further and further away from the concept of the individual. Of course, there's an individual. And at the same time, we are paying more attention, I suppose, or attention. I believe narrative therapy always did. But there's a number of people that, like Rosa Arteaga, who works specifically in gender violence, who I think does the best gender violence work in the world. She now is interviewing the body specifically, the violated body and the person in that relationship mm-hmm. together, and forming contracts with the body. So there's an attention specifically on the somatics in the body. Christine, who lives up in Whistler, where you skied, mm-hmm. She is now headlong into narrative informed working with psychedelic medicines. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be quite fascinating. As the world around us demands more and more of individual wellness and what do you call that? More of a focus on the self. Mm-hmm. And within the neoliberal context, I think it's important, and I think we're doing this, is we're having more of a crafted, easy to see, common sense therapy that looks at the context. And I think in some ways we are being less polite about it, because in some ways this idea of the internal state psychology's individual, Chris, has got to pass, you know. And this is at a time when we're critiquing, and rightly so, all forms of colonization. Mm-hmm. And I feel that internal state psychology is one of the last bastions of severe, undiscussed, not discussed colonization that's happening. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's something we should draw our attention to. And I know that we are. I guess the other part of it, Chris, is that we're really, really interested in the next generation. Mm-hmm. And we are doing a lot we're focused our supervision, a lot of our training courses, a lot of our support, a lot of the people that we're throwing support behind, bringing into the conference situations, like when you presented in the conference, mm-hmm. you weren't a next generation, but you understand the power of that conference and how exciting that conference. And we want to bring persons in, because I think on the other side, and this is critical, that the level of education and supervision and practicums, et cetera, that people are receiving, I just think that it's pretty underwhelming, and I think it's very disappointing. And I think that many of the people that we train, they came in with a lot of ideas and passion around creativity, but they're getting quite dispirited. And I think it's our generation and us that really need to find ways to prop up that spirit and creativity, right, and open landscapes and possibilities for that to happen. So that's a few of the things.
Wonderful. Okay, last question for you, and I'm very curious as well, because I know you're a reader and all of that stuff, but what books, films, ideas, music — I know you like music — what's capturing your attention these days? What's getting you excited?
I've been reading a lot about nutritionism. Oh. And the whole state of the food industry. That's been interesting. And what's interesting about it is that it's developed in very much the same ways as internal state psychology. I've been reading a lot about climate. Of course, I've been on the outskirts, but completely fascinated with the Middle East for about 25 years, and so I'm trying to read as a way of I don't know, having a relationship with something that doesn't break my heart. I don't know. There's a historian out of the University of Boston. Her name is Margaret Cox, is it? She's got a really good. I've just read her book on the history of the Constitution in America because I'm trying. We're north of the
Oh, you know
border,
what?
but.
I think I read that book too, actually.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I was on the East Coast and I saw it in a bookstore, I think. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and she lays out the history of basically saying what we're experiencing now is not that different,
No, right.
which makes
Yep.
sense
Yep.
historically around the world. So I like reading history. You know, I also read spy fiction. I mean,
Oh,
that's the
nice.
thing that keeps me away. I've been reading that for a long time. I just read a good one, you know, around the Philby affair, you know, the defection and that kind of spy stuff. Music,
I
you
have to
know,
ask, have you seen Slow Horses on Netflix? Have you seen
yeah,
that series?
I've read all those books,
Oh,
yeah.
yeah. Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. I also really have always been a fan of Gary Oldman, so
Yeah.
yeah, Slow Horses. So of that genre, you know,
Yeah.
Mick
Nice.
Herron is the writer of
Yeah.
that,
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
I haven't seen a tremendous amount of film because, you know, I've been locked up on this island and not go. I like seeing films in the theater, but a number of friends have been, you know, sending me lists that I need to go see, and I'm always revising my Spotify lists. You know, I play a lot of music in the house, in this new house I'm in on the island, and it has. Right now, I'm back. I've gone back to my West African phase I was in, particularly music from Mali, and always wanted to go. It was one of the things I really, really wanted to do. They have a fantastic festival there in the desert and an oasis. But, you know, with all the complications, what's going on politically in Mali, you know, all of that's been shut down. So I think my heart is going to the places that I'd like to go that are oppressed. And what are you reading?
I was just thinking, I just read Rebel Clinic, which was a work on France Fanon.
Ah, okay, that's really cool.
I really enjoyed it, and especially when you were talking about reading, finding, about the Middle East, and this is France and Algeria, but a lot of it is very, can play out. Very complex and nuanced descriptions of what is happening now. And so it was,
Absolutely, it is. Well, you know, I think that Fanon preceded Foucault, actually, and he's not given enough credit, meaning that, you know, he said this is not mental health. This is a cultural concern and a cultural crisis. He came out doing that in the 1950s, and Mukungu Akiniola, I know you know the name from Narrative
Yes.
Circles. He actually, I was invited to go. He went to Martinique this summer and visited a lot of Fanon's haunts. I couldn't make it, but I think we should have a chat about Franz Fanon
Yeah,
at
I
some point.
really enjoyed the book. I'm trying to
Yeah.
remember the author, but it was really well written, and and very applicable to our times. And so,
Yeah. Music?
that's a good question. What am I listening to right here? I'll show you
I don't
my
want to put you on the spot,
now
but.
here. This is the album that's out for my. It's Sly and the Family Stone, back on the right
Ah, love it.
track.
That's so
I'm getting
good.
back into vinyl, so this is
Are
why.
you? Okay. That, and what kind of guitar do you have?
That is a Martin back there.
Oh.
That's my father's Martin. He just passed away a couple weeks ago, actually. And so, yeah. And
ah, well, I'm sorry for the passing. Yeah. And
but I have another Martin over there that's mine too.
Yeah. I have a Martin right there.
Okay.
Yeah. You want to see it?
Yeah.
There it is.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
Oh.
Wait. Yeah. No.
There it is.
Yeah. I think we have the same Martin. Yep.
But anyway, well, listen.
One more question. If people want to find you, find the information about the school, what you're up
Vancouver to. School for NarrativeTherapy.com.
Yep.
And what I should say is that there's a variety of courses. We're redoing a lot of our courses these days. We finally come to the terms. In fact, this morning I got the contract right here. Conference November 7th through 9th up in Vancouver at the Arts Umbrella, which is a big school for the performing arts for kids. And we're going to have an open call probably in the next week or two, an open call for workshops. Chris Hoff, open call for workshops. Because I think you enjoyed yourself the last time.
Yeah, I did. I'd love to talk about the future and how to work.
Actually, that'd be interesting. Yes. Yeah. But you were with Mary Louise Keating the last time.
No, I was with Jay D'Arrigo. So.
Oh, no. Yeah. I know. And the two, you and Jay were talking about.
Oh, about, Latour and Anna Louise Keating.
And Latour.
Gloria Anzaldúa.
Yeah, that's right. Well, consider it. And VSNT.live, I just think is a really cool place for people to get hundreds and hundreds of videos. And because I moved last summer, I've kind of neglected the site for a bit, but after this book, my new book is coming out, the third edition in July. Yeah. And, that to become a new edition, you have to change 25%. I didn't know that, but that's what you have to do. But this third edition will probably be upwards of 60% change, and that's from 2019. So that's kind of exciting. And I don't know. We just love to hear from you, and if there's any way that we can support people, and if there's any way that we can support the Radical Therapist, what version is this? What number are we at?
I think we're 120-something. I didn't actually look, but yeah. But it's been about 6 or 7 years now, I think. Probably 7 years.
Congratulations. Yeah, I mean, I just feel that it's such an honorable and interesting and important connection that you are allowing us to connect with therapists around the world.
Right.
So I just want to thank you for that.
Yeah. Thanks.
I know it takes a lot of work to do what you're doing, and keep on doing it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I appreciate you making the time, and I hope we can do this again. And I mean,
absolutely.
We could keep talking. So.
I bet we could. I'm sure you've got better things to do though today. So thanks, Chris, and best of luck with everything. And I hope you play some beautiful songs on that. Your father is Martin.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
See you, man.
Peace. Welcome to The Radical Therapist. We are now at episode number 124. My name is Chris Hoff. And as always, thanks for listening. Today we have a wonderful episode with the longtime narrative therapy practitioner, writer, teacher, trainer, therapist, what have you, Stephen Madigan. So I've been wanting to have this conversation for a long time, and we were able to make it happen, and I'm very excited about that. And before we get to Stephen, I have one quick announcement. Some of you might know that in my day job, I direct a California Family Institute, which is a nonprofit located in Southern California. And we are a community counseling practice, and we also train graduate, postgraduate therapists that are interested in, post-structural narrative, collaborative therapy, and all the stuff. So besides that, it's our 10th anniversary. Yeah, we've been doing this for 10 years. And in my community, The numbers are those who have that sought help in my community, nearly 50% of the people that have sought help, meaning looking for a therapist, that kind of thing, could not access that help. And so that's our mission. And nobody's turned away, no matter what they can afford. And and so it's our 10th year. We're having our first ever fundraiser. So yes, this is an appeal. I don't know what kind of appeal, but, you know, I'm just putting it out there. If anybody wants to, we're doing a month of May event. So you'll probably hear stuff from me, but we're doing basically a no gala. You can buy a ticket to not attend. So how's that? So anyway, and we'll take any donation. It doesn't matter how small, to support the services, that kind of thing. So, or if you want to sponsor, if you have a practice or a training program or whatever, and you want to, you know, we'll spread your word. I mean, we're going to talk a lot about you for the month of May. So, and there's sponsorship opportunities for that too. So, if you're not already, come follow us at, Instagram at California Family Institute, or you can follow me on my Instagrams. I don't know how much I'll be mentioning it on the Radical Therapist Instagram, but, you know, come follow the California Family Institute Instagram, and you can stay in touch with all of that and any sort of help or support, or even just sharing our message, you know, while we're doing all this stuff. That would be really, really helpful too. That works. So anyway, that's my appeal for this episode. And so let's get to our guest. Yeah, long time coming. Really happy to have had this conversation. For the few of you that might not know, Stephen Madigan is an award-winning narrative therapist, best-selling author, training director of the Vancouver School of Narrative Therapy, content manager for VSNT.live. I'll have links for both of those places in the show notes. And he's a longtime supervisor to international high couple conflict teams. He wrote the first ever doctoral dissertation on narrative therapy, and his therapy work is studied in graduate university programs across the world through various media forms, such as the American Psychological Association's production of a set of 6 professional learning videos filming his live narrative practice. He wrote the best first and second editions of the book Narrative Therapy, published in 2011 and then 2019, and the third edition will be published soon in July 2024. Stephen teaches, trains, and consults, supervises globally. So without further ado, let's meet Stephen.